This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Wow. Welcome to the Living Free Show. My name is Michael. Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio crew for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. This is a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM radio or 3CR Digital, or maybe even live streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael, as I said, and I'm joined in the studio by, well, just my guest today. Today we've asked Connor to share his experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. And before we do that, we'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. Also, please note that the Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. So please consider your well-being and that of others while listening. Welcome, Connor.
Hello.
It's great that you could join me in the studio today. We'd like to start by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like growing up as Connor?
Hello, I'm Connor, I'm an alcoholic. Don't know how to start.
That's exactly how we start, isn't it?
I grew up for what I thought was normal, you know. I was a kid growing up in the eastern suburbs and, you know, went to school.
Family, big family, small family?
Big family. I'm one of five.
Wow, that is a big family.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to have mum stay at home. I resented her for it a lot. I grew up in that sort of, a bit more patriarchal sort of view. And I think I was reflecting on that the other day, that, you know, how I treated my mum. I was the eldest son, so I had my old man to look up to. I grew up with dad. He is an alcoholic. He goes to AA. I was a weird kid, I think. I started going to, like, psychiatrists and psychologists ever since I could remember. You know, my parents could just tell something was off. And around the age of 13 and stuff, I never really had much problem in school. I think I wore a mask pretty well and blended in. I was 15, you know, when I picked up my first drink, I went from being that kid who put on a mask to almost just being it, you know. I can't describe it, but everything that I did and everybody around me and everything, I did not fit in. And no matter how much validation and stuff that I sought, it was never enough. So when I picked up my first drink, it was the best thing that ever happened in my life. You know, I could talk to people the way I wanted to. I could be confident the way I thought I should be. I could do everything, you know. And it wasn't long until I started drinking at school. I started isolating drinking because I thought people would find out and everything.
So how old were you then? You're like 13 or 14?
I was 15 when I picked up my first drink.
You were old.
Yeah.
In AA speak, really.
Yeah.
And what is the language? You go, I held out as long as I could.
Yeah. Well, I look at my younger brother and he's done the same as me, you know. He vowed that he'd never pick up a drink. You know, I watched my old man drink and I thought, I'm never going to do that. It was only until I used to play field hockey and that's where I got introduced to my first drink, and yeah, it was off and running. And it was funny. when I picked up my first string at 15, and it was the same time that my old man started going to meetings. So he put down the drink, and I picked it up. So it was tense. Our relationship was always tense.
It's a difficult thing to watch as a parent. Like, I've watched my my daughters, you know, start drinking at around about that age.
Yeah.
And the fear in my head as the recovering alcoholic, watching that happen, going, gee, I hope they're not like me. Yeah, I hope they're not like me. You know, and then having that complete awareness around the fact that, oh my God, and then I'm watching them like a hawk to see whether they're drinking like me.
Yeah.
I imagine it would have been difficult for you to watch it as well.
Yeah.
So that I can understand the tension.
Yeah, well, he was the first. He brought me to my first meeting.
Awesome.
So I picked up a drink at 15, and at 16 years old, he brought me to my first meeting.
He recognised it.
Yeah, and that scared the hell out of me, because it was a mixture of emotions. Like, I remember sitting there identifying with, not necessarily with the words they were saying, just how they felt, and that scared me. Because, you know, at that time, you know, I've made amends to my old man, but at that time and for many years, I held massive resentments towards him. And for him, you know, I've just picked up something that made me feel good in my life, and now he's bringing me to an AA meeting, and it just that ego and pride, like, no, you're not going to be the one to fix me, you know. So
how dare you take this away from me? Like, yeah. I only just started.
Yeah. And, I look back on that, and I'm so grateful that he did, you know. But it meant that many, you know, after that first meeting, my drinking was sort of, I always had it in the back of my mind that maybe I'm an alcoholic. And it sort of disrupted my drinking a lot, you know. And for a time there, I used to, you know, throughout my 20s and stuff, I used to justify it because I thought I was an alcoholic, you know. I kind of knew there was a problem. Everyone around me could see it was a problem. I knew it was a problem, but I couldn't stop drinking.
Mm.
So I turned to drugs. I turned to drugs, as any good alcoholic does, I think, like trying to get off it. But I never could. And I was thinking about it, just before, you know, blackouts and things like that. I used to...
Do you want to describe what a blackout is for you?
I just don't remember the night. Mm. You know, I remember nothing of it. I used to love those.
I don't think normal, because normal drinkers don't have it. Like, if I'm listening to it as a normal drinker, I'd never heard what a blackout was until I got to AA, and then I heard people describing it. Like, that wasn't my experience of my drinking. I remember everything I did, which is terrible. Like, I'd give anything to not remember some of the things I did.
Yeah.
But having people describe it to me and go, oh, actually, I'm doing all this stuff and I'm functional and I'm out there and I have no control over my body. Like, my body's doing stuff and it's not, my brain isn't engaged with it.
Yeah.
It's just all my memory's not engaged with it. And I do things, I imagine, the things we do in blackout, the stories I hear from people doing stuff in blackout is like, you know, my morals are different, everything's different.
Well, I'd wake up in God knows where, you know, with God knows who, and I'd find myself in situations, you know, I remember passing out in a, I don't know how I got in there, you know, and it's not like I grew up in a bad household or anything like that. You know, we grew up quite well off, you know, relatively speaking. And for me to, you know, it's not really where you think an alcoholic comes from, but here I am getting absolutely sloshed. All my mates are done dealing with me for the night. So, you know, just one of the many times I found myself in a bad situation, and I was in Southern Cross Station. And somehow I'd got into one of those booths where you pay for the tickets or whatever. I can't really remember. And then the Red Cross was nudging me, like, how the hell did you get in here? And they're like, you got to get out of here. If the cops find you, they'll arrest you. And they drove me, you know, this this drunk, arrogant kid from the southeast down to back home an hour away.
Wow.
And they see where I've been living, you know, and it was always like, you, like, what are you doing with your life? You know, what have you, like, as if we're picking this kid up off the street because he can't handle his alcohol. You know, but for me, I had to drink. I didn't know where I was going to end up. And then I'd wake up the next day, you know, my mum's berating me for what she had to carry me out of the car, apparently. I was in a blackout. She had to carry me out of the car. And I'd wake up the next morning, like, just full of guilt, resentment, and regret and all these sort of things, but I couldn't show it, you know. And I'd go, oh, it's just another night, you know. So I would go and do it again. And that's usually how I did it. I'd compensate for all those feelings of regret and guilt and all that sort of stuff by picking up another drink. And it wasn't until my actions and behaviour really started affecting my relationships that I go, I got to stop. So I tried to go back to AA. You know, I think I revisited AA when I was like 21. And I'd go to a meeting once a week or once every 2 weeks. And looking back on it, I used it to almost be like, well, I've deserved a drink now. Yeah. I've just gone to a meeting. It's okay.
I've listened to those stories.
Yeah. I just couldn't, you know, we call it surrender. I couldn't surrender to what was on offer. And I couldn't, I wasn't in enough pain, I guess, to just go, I can't keep doing this.
Were you living at home?
No, I was at a rental. I thought I was doing all right. I never had any money. I was working. I never had any money. My partner was always scared. Of what she'd wake up to if I'd, because I'd use my drinking as also like a weapon as well. Like you've annoyed me, so I'm going to go out and drink, and I won't text you the whole night, or I won't let you know what's happening because you have to sit in what you've done to me. Just yep. full selfish, self-centered, self-pity. I was full of it, you know. Didn't know I was feeling that way. I just knew I felt bad, but that's what I was. That's who I am, you know.
Certainly, a language that we learn later on, isn't it? That to look back and know our behaviours previously and be able to put words to it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, when I'm in it, I'm just doing it. It's just, it's normal.
Well, I didn't know any other option. You know, I just knew that if I picked up a drink, I felt better. But later on in my drinking, if I picked up a drink, things would get worse. You know, I wouldn't wake up to a sympathetic partner. I'd wake up to somebody who's really annoyed at me, and I go, okay, I'm going to stop. You know, and I'd have, you know, my old man looking at me like, what? Go to a meeting, but he had to stay from a distance because he knew that if he intervened, he'd wreck the relationship with me. And I didn't want a relationship with him, but I wanted a relationship with him, you know, and my parents and everybody else, but I couldn't, I didn't know.
Yeah, what's that language? You can tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell them much.
Yeah.
Like, don't you be telling me about my drinking.
Yeah.
Like, and I guess that's eventually I've got to hear someone, you know, what was your experience of first time, say, getting identification more than just, you know, when did the surrender come?
I think it came, it wasn't so much somebody. I think my last bust, so I'm 22 months sober. My last bust was probably my worst. And it was, you know,
How old are you?
27. And so I've been, you know, yeah. That was always a sore point as well, like being young and going into AA is, I'd go to meetings and I'd go, well, I didn't do that. I haven't done that yet, you know, yet. And you get the yets. But the thing is, I'd come to AA from 16 thinking that none of that stuff had happened in 10 years. And those things started happening in 10 years. And I'm like, you buggers. Like,
yeah. Well, you put that so nicely. You buggers. Yeah.
You don't know me. You know? My last one, my relationships was really on the rocks. But the thing that changed that last time was that the alcohol, it wasn't doing what I wanted it to do. I still felt just numb and I was still aware in my head, you know. I consumed, I'd go out by myself on an ego pride trip, just trying to feel better about myself and get validation from everybody else. And my head was just still full of all the stuff, even though I was absolutely plastered. And I woke up the next day and I was at this crossroads, you know. It was either I go to AA and pick up a drink. Oh, sorry. I either go to AA and give it a go, because obviously it's worked for my old man for 10 years and all the other people, or I kill myself. You know, I was pretty ready, you know. And I walked into my first that AA meeting, and I there was somebody there, and they just offered me, you know, we got the big book. They offered me a book, and something about it, the way you just gave it to me, you know, didn't say you owe this, you need to pay this. It was like nah, here's a book. I instantly said, I don't have the money to pay for it. And they said, no, don't worry about it. I said, I'll pay you next week. And I remember rummaging out in the car. You know, I'll be like, no, I'll see if I've got it, knowing that I don't have the money for the book. And I've gone out to the car and I just sat there like, I felt like I wanted to drive off with this book in hand. And I'm like, this person's just shown me some kindness. And no, I've got to go in there and just be sorry, I don't have the money. And that was where I was.
Awesome. We might just leave it there and we'll come back, because that's a really good place to stop. You've done your first meeting and you've met someone who's given you some hope, and we'll come back and we'll just play a song. And this is John Butler. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM radio, or 3CR on digital radio, or maybe even streaming on 3cr.org.au. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you could find us on your preferred podcast platform, or just search for 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone or email. Today we're talking to Connor about his recovery from alcoholism Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe. Before the break, you sort of gave us an insight into your introduction to alcohol and the background a little bit. And you know, and the fact that you talked about just at the end about your first meeting, but where you made a decision to stop. But my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's not the first port of call. It's not the place of, you know, where you go, yes, you know, when I started drinking 28 years ago, I finally made it to AA. You know, that's my plan when I was from 13 to 41 for me. So you obviously. Had you tried other stuff? You know, have you tried other ways to control or manage your drinking or your behaviours or your thinking? Or had you tried other stuff leading up to that?
Yeah, I'd tried psychologists, psychiatrists, tried drugs, tried everything to avoid trying to pick up a drink. I was 7-8 when I got admitted to a psych ward. I think that was my first, I think that was a bit ego shattering, at the time. And I think it didn't stop me drinking. It probably even enhanced my drinking, because I came out of there thinking, you know, depression, anxiety, all those things that I got labeled with, was my problem. And I remember coming out of there thinking, I'm fixed. I'm fixed. I can drink how I want to. My drinking actually took a notch up, but it was also, I remember my ego not being able to recover because I've got these labels now, but also I've also got an excuse for why I can drink. I'd tried plenty of different things. I'd even, you know, I'd been successful in trying to stop myself.
What does success look like when you say you've been successful at trying to stop?
Not very.
Oh man, but our definition of success is pretty good. Like they go, I didn't drink for 3 days.
Yeah. Well, I think up until before I went to AA, this time around, I was dry drunk for about for a few months, because I knew if I picked up that drink, my partner would be leaving, and it was only until I couldn't hold it in, I inevitably picked up a drink without having another solution. And
yeah, otherwise the language in the book is the book Alcoholics Anonymous is that we get restless, irritable, and discontent. Yeah. And you know, the people around us, you know, are suffering from us not drinking. You know, my absolute needing to white knuckle, not drinking. I know for me it was, there was a sign on my head that said, I'm not drinking. And so, don't be talking to me. I can't talk to you and not drink. And and don't expect me to be nice because I can't be nice and not drink. And don't expect me to show up there because with the family because I can't do that and not drink at the same time. I'm a man. I can't multitask these two things. Whilst I'm not drinking, my complete focus is in not drinking. And so don't expect anything else of me.
Yeah.
Is that, was that your experience?
Yeah. Yeah. I found myself doing, absolutely nothing. I quit my job. I crashed my car. I was sitting around thinking of, I look back on it now and I go, what was I thinking? But I joined university because I thought that I needed to become a doctor to be, to feel good about myself. You know, I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't well.
And, you called it successful.
Yeah.
Which I love. Like, that's what the definition of success is. And I've done this. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah. So it's funny. Well, it was even, I was probably around the same sort of headspace without drinking when I was first in AA. For about the first 6 months, I'd just skated across different meetings. And I'd always choose the small meetings. And people, I don't know, there wasn't much laughter in some meetings and there wasn't, I found it really easy to just blend in, you know, and just, I was there, I did my meeting, I went home, I looked good on paper and I was...
Ticked the box.
Yeah. And it was only until, about 6 months, I could feel that urge, like I knew I was going to pick up a drink again. And I'd never looked at, in an AA meeting, there's two banners. One of them's the steps, one of them is the traditions. And I'd always look down at them, like in terms of I couldn't look at them because they scared me. I was like, I don't want to put a set of rules into my life. Like I've skated along just fine up until now. But I was like, everyone in those meetings was talking about they've done the steps, they've got a sponsor, they've done da 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 da. And it was about that 6 months mark where I said, okay, I need to take this step. Just as I'd done when I first got into those rooms, I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know that this person was going to offer me a book. I didn't know that the kindness and the language in the rooms. I went into those rooms thinking, well, help me stop drinking. Why are you talking about your feelings? Why are you talking about going for runs? Why are you talking about all this other stuff and God and things like that and all that? And I think in a way I put all that stuff on the back burner a bit and I just tried to get to as many meetings as possible and not look too far into it because I knew it scared me off previously.
Mm.
6 month mark, I went to a different meeting this time and I found somebody who was willing to sponsor me. And from then on, it actually changed my life.
And was it the first person you asked?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that I found someone who was willing to do it.
Yeah.
It's actually, if I want to point out to anybody listening that everybody is willing to do it. Like, that, like, it's the thing that keeps us sober is that carrying the message to the next person to go, actually, this stuff works. And but the hardest thing in the world is to ask someone to do it. It's almost like dating. It's but worse. This is life and death. And I think that what if they say no? And they don't say no.
No,
I know. My experience is I'm not allowed to say no. That stuff. But it's great. Eventually, we get in enough pain that we ask.
Yeah,
we ask for help. We go, actually, I can't do this stuff by myself, which I guess is the first step. The first step really is that in Alcoholics Anonymous is I can't do this by myself. One way or the other, I'm going to drink. And so therefore, I've got to have some help. And, I've never asked for help in any place in my life. I've self-sufficiency, I'm going to run my life. And even if it's going to burn to the ground, I burned it. So, I've got some authorship with that. And look what I did. And I want to boast about it. And I'll tell you, I might tell you the good bits that have worked out, and I won't tell you about all that stuff that didn't really quite work out. Well, I'll find a language that makes it sound a lot better. Yeah. So you've got someone who's willing to sponsor you. And what does that look like for you time-wise?
I think it's evolved. But at that time, I was was doing things I didn't think were important, but I had to do. If I wanted to keep this sponsor, I had to do what they said, and it was I had to call him every day, which was uncomfortable to say the least.
Mm.
Because it's like asking for help every single time, like I've got to call them. And it was that moved on to, okay, calling every day. Then the following week it was doing a gratitude list every day. And it's, what am I grateful for? And, you know, for somebody who's been living in self-pity their whole life, looking for things to be grateful for is pretty hard. Even though nothing's wrong in my, you know, like I can see now, like nothing, the only thing wrong in my life is me. You know, things around me, they move with or without me, you know, and everything's actually fine in my life. But it's taken a while for me to see that, you know, and doing those actions of a gratitude list every day, you know, writing 10 things down of what I'm grateful for. And they're as simple as, you know, hearing some birds chirping. You know, I didn't used to notice that when I was drinking, or even when I'm not traveling spiritually well. You know, in recovery, if I'm not traveling well, I won't hear that. I won't see that there's people smiling on the street. I'll just see thinking that somebody's laughing at me, or everything's surrounded by me, and everything's me centered. And if I'm not doing a program, you know, gratitude list, calling a sponsor, and that's evolved to once a week, calling my sponsor, gratitude list every day. Then I started doing meditation. That was uncomfortable, and it took a while. Yeah, it took a while for that to almost like just that all that chattering in my head that was so constant, it slowly just dialed back a little bit.
Mm.
And I remember being with my sponsor for maybe 2 or 3 months, and doing all these things and being like, "Why? What's going on? Like, nothing's changed. I still feel the same," you know. And I remember sitting in a rugby match. Actually, it was the first time in my life where my head actually just switched off. And I remember watching this game of rugby, and for the first time, like in my life, it was just peace. It wasn't happiness. It wasn't sadness. It just was. It was just being present. And that's when I went, oh, is that what he's talking about?
It's amazing, isn't it? Because it doesn't look like the solution to the problem that what I'm suffering from. I've got this physical problem, and this mental that creates mental anguish, and then the solution doesn't look like the solution to that problem.
No.
I'm going to go and do this other stuff. I'm going to, you know, how could meditation look after that? How could, you know, calling somebody once a day, how could be writing down the things that I'm grateful for, how could those things be the solution? Because, you know, I think that I need to not drink, because then the problem will go away, because the problem is obviously my drinking. And I've got a whole heap of other problems going on that I don't really know the name of.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing is applying a solution to those things, even if I can't name them.
Yeah.
And I get to name them as I keep going along, I guess. And so did you start the step straight away?
No, I don't think so. I think there was a bit of a, I think there was a little bit of a period, like a couple of weeks, whilst my sponsor, I think he wanted to know that I was committed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the first few weeks, I think we used to just do, you know, online meetings. And I think it got to the stage where he was kind enough to bring me into his home, and we started the steps. And, you know, the first step is my life. I'm unmanageable with my life, you know, and and what's the rest of it? I don't even know.
You admitted you were powerless over alcohol, and your life was unmanageable. Not even and. Your life is unmanageable, and you're powerless over alcohol.
Yeah,
you can't control it when you put it in there, and when you make a decision to not drink, eventually you're going to drink.
Yeah. I remember learning that or reading that, and I didn't understand the language straight away. I think unmanageable, I used to think of, I instantly thought of the externals. You know, I'd crash my car, I'd lost all my money, I'd my relationship was bad and things like that. But it was my sponsor who said the unmanageable thing is actually it's got nothing to do. It's in your head, you know. I can't manage what's going on in here, and that rang true for me, and I can see it more today. Like I'm still an alcoholic. I still think the same, you know. It's just I have a program to help with what's going on in here, you know, and so the first step, I think, for a while, sorry, I'm getting a bit nervous.
Okay.
I think I'd accepted that I couldn't handle alcohol for a while, but I didn't realise how tied it was to my own thinking. It was, you know, in terms of I thought the desire to drink was separate to my own thoughts. I thought my thoughts were helping me stay away from it, and the fear around drinking was actually helping me, but it wasn't. It's that fear that drives me back to drinking. It's that fear around people and places and what's going on around me that it keeps me in a state of anxiousness, and no wonder I wanted to drink all the time because I couldn't escape it.
It's called anxious separation or anxious apartness. We're stuck in this place where we don't feel part of other people. Who, you know, like that was my experience of going to AA, is that I found a place that I belonged, and because they had the same thing. And I'm spending all this time nodding my head when they're talking about their drinking. I'm going, yep, like I'm all like a bobblehead sitting on a dashboard. Just yep. But when it comes to my, you know, my emotional stuff, I don't even know what my emotional stuff is. And so when I stop drinking after a period of time, the emotional stuff all comes up. And I go, oh, I need to put some names to this. I need to put some names to some of this stuff that's going on. And I didn't know it was all fear. I didn't know it was all, but I was worried about what you thought about me, or I was worried about, you know, the fact that I wasn't going to have enough, or I was never going to have sex again in my life, or I was, you know, whatever, you know, that I was so worried about how I was going to get my instincts or my needs met, what I thought my needs were. And I worried about it. I spent so much energy, mental energy, worrying about stuff that I had no control over.
Yeah.
That was unmanageability for me.
I used to drive myself to the point of, I remember before my parents actually sent me into a hospital because I thought that I had a brain inflammation, because I had headaches for about 2 years of my life straight, like every day when I was in school, and they sent me to a hospital, and you know, to have headaches and migraines, and it just come on out of nowhere, and I see that now. It was just the absolute chaos that was going on in my head. I couldn't shut it up, you know. So I picked up a drink. And it just pacified it, you know. It was still there, but it was like, just go away, you know. like you just stay over there, and I'm in control now.
Yeah, because alcohol is an amazing drug to quiet the mind.
Yeah.
That negative, you know, we've talked about this before, but that negative self-talk, that negative self, that voice in the back of my head that's ongoing.
Yeah,
it's ongoing. That tells me that I'm not enough. And when I'm behaving poorly because of the way I drink, that's reinforced.
Yeah.
I go, actually, yeah. But when I stop drinking, a lot of those behaviours change. And I still believe that voice that's in my head. And I guess the program from, you know, is going to teach me that actually that's a lie. That thing's lying to me constantly.
Yeah.
That voice is just constantly lying to me. And am I going to engage with it? How am I going to stop that voice from, how am I going to stop myself from engaging and believing the voice in my head? Because it sounds like me. It's me talking to me.
Yeah.
About me. So there's a lot of me in there again.
I think that's where that the gift of desperation is. Trusting in something that I was trusting in somebody else, almost handing over. Just I feel so bad, and I'm in enough pain. Just help, and trusting that I know that this thing isn't working. I'd learned plenty of times, you know, through all those psychs and all those hospitals and all the going through AA, through all that, and just asking somebody else for help, and trusting in not knowing. Because my head would come up with a million different scenarios of how this was going to play out.
Yep.
And they were always negative. They were always, the world's going to end, you know.
Yep.
And it was like life or death all the time. And I just said, I give up on that.
Cool.
And I need to give it to a sponsor, you know. And that's where somebody guides me through the steps and gives me some tools to help deal with that stuff. on a day-to-day basis, you know. And it's one, and one of the things I heard first time was really helped me was just one day at a time. And if I can't do it one day at a time, I do it, you know, an hour at a time. And if I can't do it an hour at a time, I just do it. And it's just like breaking the day down, because my head will, if I, and I can see it more often now, you know. I'm working away at the moment, and I can see myself not being in a great spiritually when I'm away. And it's made me come to a decision to come back home. If I'm not doing spiritually well, I instantly start thinking, you know, 5 years in the past or 5 years in the future. And the more I think about what's going to happen and how I'm going to control that stuff, the sicker I get, because I get my grubby fingers into everything. And as soon as I start trying to manipulate things and change things, and I don't realize I'm doing it either. When I'm sick, I don't realize I do these things. But I start, my attitude changes, my actions change towards I need to control this because I'm scared of the outcome. And this outcome is completely fictitious in my head. But it's all the stuff, that's the same stuff that kept me drinking, you know, and that kept me coming back to a drink, because I thought I couldn't control what was going on. And it wasn't the reality I was living in. You know, that's not the reality. The reality is right now I can see that I'm sitting in a room. I'm sitting with somebody I trust.
Yep.
I've got a sponsor. I've got family around me. I've got loved ones. And I'm okay with not knowing what's going to happen for the rest of the day.
Yep.
And it scares me if I think about it. But I've got things to try to help mitigate what's going on in here all the time, and thoughts, you know. It sounds so condescending, but when my sponsor used to say, but you know, feelings aren't facts, I'm like, well, yeah. You see how much pain I'm in? Of course it's a fact. Like, I feel justified in what I'm feeling. Because look at what this person's done, and look at what this person's done, and they've done this to me. And I used to hold so many resentments and judgments on everybody else that I didn't know why I was so angry all the time. You know, I was so angry with myself, with everybody else, with the world. And then even then, I'd go from hating the world to 10 minutes later loving everything in my life. And I was always at two opposite ends of the spectrum, and there was no in between. And in recovery, I've sort of tried to move more in. It's trying to find that balance and that middle. In my life, and yeah
cool. Okay, well, we would like to take a break there. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR on 855 AM radio, or digital radio, or live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. Today we're talking to Connor about his recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've heard about what it was like initially, and his introduction to AA and the things that he's done in AA, the taking the steps, and now we're just going to have a quick chat about what it looks like now. What does life look like for you?
Continual learning experience.
Yep.
I think I shared on this at one of the other meetings, and you know, I was driving back home from interstate on Friday, and I haven't had one of these for a little bit, but I was having a panic attack, and instantly my whole world like just shifted. Like I was I'm somebody who's in recovery, and I've got this, you know, this idea that for some reason I'm almost immune from feeling bad because I'm in recovery. And I'm thinking, you know, My partner's going to break up with me as soon as I step in the door. I've got to break up with her. That for some reason, the people that I've known in AA, you know, they've been lying to me this whole time. And my family didn't want me. Just my head going nuts. And in that moment, I called my sponsor. And, you know, and I'm talking about this stuff, and he just sort of laughs. He goes, yeah, okay. like, you know, it's in laughing in understanding, you know, in knowing what I'm thinking, because the only people who understand an alcoholic as well, the only people who understand me is another alcoholic. And that feeling I get in AA and stuff, is the fact that I'm understood. You know, everywhere in my everyday life, I feel misunderstood and all that sort of feeling and stuff. And in AA, I walk in there, and as soon as I'm honest, instantly people pick up on it, and I feel like I'm with my people.
Mm.
So talking to my sponsor, you know. But you know, that's I still have plenty of ups and downs. Mm. of this learning thing, but the one thing that stays true is that I've got AA, you know, that I was able to go to a meeting that night and listen and get out of my own head and have people to call in my life where things when things aren't going well, not externally necessarily, but in my head, I've got AA to go to. And as long as I steer towards that and not a drink, because my head will tell me that I need a drink, you know. And in recovery, plenty of times I've found myself, you know, across the road and seeing a pub, and I go, that seems interesting, you know. Mm. Like I get those rose tinted glasses of what I used to want from alcohol, you know, and forgetting all the stuff I put people through. But these days, I have I'm grateful that I get to go to a meeting. And that they're there, and that when I go to a meeting, I'll still be in my own head, but I'm safe, you know. And I remember when I, and it still rings true, but when I was in really early recovery, I'd go and do a meeting, and I felt safe for that first, for an hour or an hour and a half in my life. I felt like, well, I know I'm not picking up a drink for this time frame. I don't know what's going to happen later, but as long as I'm just trying to stay present in this meeting and talking to these people and getting out of my own head, you know, my sponsor, when I'm in those positions, will go call somebody else. Get out of your head and go show interest in somebody else.
Mm.
And it works, you know. I go, how's that going to help me? Like, I've got this problem and this problem, because this is what my head's telling me, that this is the problem and this is my reality. But he goes, go talk to somebody else. And then... more often than not, I go, oh, wow, you know.
Yeah, you still go, wow, that worked again.
Yeah. How self-centered can I get, you know? And I don't realise I'm doing it. I know that I feel bad, you know, in those moments. I know that I feel bad. I'm not feeling right, but I can't put my finger on how, because it's, you know, it's
yeah,
my head talks to me in my own voice, you know.
Mm. My sponsor does the same. Like he says, I can't tell you what's wrong, but I know that something's not right. And that's my language I would say to him. And then his solution doesn't look like the solution. Is, you know, to go and do something for somebody else. And you go, you don't understand. You don't understand. But how's that going to help? I really get that. And I guess the other thing about, being honest in Alcoholics Anonymous, with that, you know, you said that one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic is that they get each other. But there's also, it's not a, I don't feel judged, and like I know that judgment happens. That's absolutely normal. But there's nothing that someone can tell me about if they're going to be honest with me, that I can't say, actually, I've thought about doing it, or I've done it myself.
Yeah.
And like, I've come from the same place of thinking, because it's always self-centered. It's always fear-driven, or it's self-centered, or it's dishonest. And I go, yeah, and I just have to laugh. And so, you know, when you sit around with another bunch of alcoholics and we're talking these stories, and they're horror stories sometimes, and that's why I find it hilarious. I've watched non-alcoholics sit in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and the horror stories are happening, and we're all laughing. and it looks like really dark humour. But the fact is that we all get it. We all just sit there and go, oh, yeah, been there. Oh, yeah, I did that. Oh, yeah. You know, or I couldn't imagine doing that even if I didn't do it. And the non-alcoholic is just sitting there going, you're kidding, right?
Yeah.
They're like, and how could you guys be sitting around like, that's a tragedy? And you go, well, actually, you know, I have to laugh, because I'm sitting here with a bunch of other people who, like, this is my safe place.
Yeah.
Where I can sit here and be completely authentic and own my behaviour. And it's useful. Like, me sharing my poor behaviours actually is helping that next person who comes along and then doesn't feel so alone, because they're sitting there going, oh, my God, it's not just me.
Yeah.
And who knew that that was ever going to be an asset, that stuff, that the terrible things that happened when we drank, or then our thinking, even when we're sober, when we're honest about it, that the next person who's listening goes, oh, my God, it's okay. I thought I needed to be perfect, Because in lots of other areas of my life, I feel the need to be perfect in my workplace, in my relationships, and all this stuff. But in AA, I can just be completely broken. Yeah, even on a really good day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, are you enjoying it? Like, are you enjoying sobriety?
Yeah. Yeah. It's changed my life. And honestly, I think it's a given. If you put down the drink for long enough, you know, and you work towards getting better in life, the externals get better.
Mm.
But it's not the externals that are important. It's the way I feel, you know, and the way I feel about people and myself. Not having that, you know, my first thought in the morning when I wake up is still about me.
Yep.
But I have something in place today to help me cope with what's going on in here, you know.
Mm.
And
the struggle is real. It's in there.
Yeah, it's completely changed my life, and that's only by the love and the support from other members. And 22 months ago, if you said I'd be sitting here in a radio show,
yeah,
talking about my recovery. I mean, to be fair, I look at my past behaviour and all I do is talk about myself, so it's probably not too hard. But I think that's my life's changed in ways that I didn't think could. I'm more at peace with what's happening around me. I no longer feel like I have I need to control everything in my life, and that the only way things are going to get better in my life is if I get involved, you know, with relationships, with my job, with everything like that. My experience in AA is the less I have to do with it, usually the better it is.
Yep, makes sense.
Yeah, but...
Cool. I think that's about all the time we've got today. So I'd like to thank you. Really, really appreciate you coming in to the studios and sharing your experience. You know, and I hope that that people can listen. Join us next week when Anne will be chatting with a guest about recovery. And coming up next, we've got Bullamwah, The Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Tolgum Choco Edwards. And join Uncle Choco in The Spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. And thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR. We'll take us out with some more music.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.